we're doing another review incentive. So at the end of May 2024, we're going to pick one person who wrote a review between now and then to get a free one-on-one session with me. Instructions are in the description of this episode. And I just want to express how much I appreciate you. At this point, if you're a regular listener, you've got a whole bunch of access to the truth of who I am and to my soul. And that makes me feel really, really good. That is exactly the type of relationship that I want for us to be cultivating together. So thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for your review. I hope it's you that I get to do a one-on-one with. I appreciate you so much. Hello, and welcome to the Flynn Skidmore podcast. My goal is to help you become exactly who you want to be. We are here to help you take your biggest, boldest, most beautiful vision for life and turn that vision into reality. Hello, and welcome back. On today's episode, we have fellow psychotherapist Ailey Jolie. Ailey also creates fantastic content on Instagram. And today we speak about navigating being cheated on, but more importantly, navigating patterns of being cheated on. We speak about transforming pain into empowerment. And we speak about developing compassionate perspectives on the people who create the most harm in the world, because we think that's the best way to change the world. All right. So we're just talking about Instagram therapist energy of like, here are five tips, and you are not that.
No, I'm definitely not that, because when I look at my own healing journey and the things that have worked for me, they've been long-term, showing up consistently every day, like the super boring stuff almost. And it is like quite boring. It's not sexy. It's not oftentimes very fun. And it doesn't make a good Instagram caption. And I've had that struggle in social media with how do I show up in such a way where I'm authentic and honor that there's an algorithm here that's at play that wants this. And also, I don't believe that these five tips are all you need.
Why do you think people want it to be five tips? Because that does seem to work really well. And I have the exact same experience. I am not tip guy. I don't have it. There's not a cell in my body that's tip guy. I like tipping service staff. I hate three tips to X. But it does seem like people really, there's something about that people are really drawn to. Like, what's your take on that?
If I like put on a little bit of my more existential like mindset and just like honor that we are all like relatively don't know what the heck is going on right now. We're like small little specks on a giant globe twirling around, and like three tips for whatever gives us a sense of control. It gives us a sense of an autonomy. It gives us a sense of a map. It makes us believe that we are that powerful, and we are powerful, and we're not in complete control of our reality. And how do we hold that tension? And also with it for me oftentimes feels almost in the spectrum of like narcissistic traits of like, here are these three things, you'll be totally healed. Aren't you glad I provided them for you? Whereas I'm like, everything that I've had to kind of find to work for myself in my own growth and development, yes, people led me there and there are breadcrumbs, but I like had to try on so many different things and really find my own way. And that's not very commodifiable because it's so personal.
What do you think has motivated you to be so persistent in experimenting with things? And sounds to me like you've fallen in love with the long game. You've fallen in love with the slow burn of all of this. You're maybe not operating with an expectation to like heal things super fast, but it's sort of a strange thing to be that motivated to not be looking for tips, but rather to take this alternative path.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to hear kind of your personal experience of this as well, or like what led you there. But I did all of the like tip-based stuff, you know, when I was really unwell and struggling in an eating disorder, I kind of went through that process and then followed those things. And then I found myself living this life that was like very health-centered, very like everything was perfect. I was doing all the things and I was like, oh my God, I'm in a different form of cage. This also isn't authentic for me to have swallowed every goop self-help thing out there and just be like walking around churning it out. I'm like, this also feels really inauthentic and I feel unwell in this life and how I was operating. But I'm curious for you, what's kind of led you to not be such a tip person as well?
For me, it's most of it has been about my body. I grew up really loving a particular version of masculinity that I would like, I loved superheroes and G.I. Joes. And when I was a pretty good athlete, but my body never looked the way that really good athletes' bodies looked. And that always, it confused me. And I had an awareness of that at an early age. And I had an awareness that like I could be doing the exact same thing that someone else is doing and their body would look one way and my body would look a different way. And it occurred to me that what's happening is that there must be a difference in the energy that's being practiced. And I know for me that a lot of my stuff with my body, I was always practicing this energy of a lot of it was like shame and performance, like eyes are watching me. I'm not actually fully immersed and in love with this activity right now. It's very much with an awareness of people seeing my body. Are they seeing like I'm chubby in this way or whatever? So I wanted to learn about what the difference in internal state was. That was my hypothesis, that I was operating with one internal state that was producing one body. A person who had what I thought was a more beautiful body was operating with a different internal state and that was producing their body. And so I became obsessed with learning about that, learning about it and applying it. Like really, it's been an obsession with learning about that. And it's only been over the last few years that I've been able to, it's become clear to me that a person who's operating with a certain level of athleticism and looks a certain way relates to their body with like relaxation and joy and appreciation. Whereas I was trying to use shame in order to get to love, but using shame to get to love just produces more shame. So that's been the thing that's motivated me.
And that's awesome. And thank you for that. Cause it also reminds me, or just makes me think of like how the tip-based thing kind of falls into that philosophy of you are something that needs to be fixed, or like something that needs to be healed by the outside, instead of like, no, everything is here that I need and I want. And maybe I want to live my life a little bit differently, or maybe I want to experience more relaxation or more peace or more freedom or have more curiosity, but it's not that there's something broken inside me that I need to go in and fix. And that's kind of where the list-based things for me, that's what it brings up in my system. I know that's not everyone, but for me, it goes instantly like, I'm
yes.
turned off.
Yes, yes. You close up immediately when there's fixed energy. One of the craziest things that I've ever been part of, I was in a somatic experiencing training session. For people who don't know, somatic experiencing is a therapeutic modality created by Peter Levine. It's mind, body, super cool, fascinating. So we're in this training and people partner up, and I can't remember exactly how they structured the exercise, but two people were facing each other. One person's eyes was closed. The practitioner in the role play, during like one of the rounds, was operating with I can fix you mantra. And then in a different round, the practitioner in the role play was operating with I trust you can heal. And then what they did was like they had people open their eyes and they somehow like had the audience guess which round the practitioner was saying heal and which one they were saying fix. And like it was a room of 300 people, like 95% of the people were somehow able to pick up on when the other person was operating with, I can fix you energy. There's something about fix energy that like hurts us.
If you pay attention to the content that I put out, the podcast, the newsletter, what I create on Instagram, the way that I engage with people in the comments, you may conclude that I love giving stuff away for free. And if you make that conclusion, you're correct. I love creating free content. And if I could, I would give you everything that you need for free in order for you to become exactly who you want to be. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to work that way. You becoming the person that you want to be is a result of a relationship over time. And that's how I'm able to really help people, or at least accelerate the process, is through relationship over time, through intimacy and getting close to one another. Now, to do that, I have three options. There's the online community that I run. I run small groups and I do one-on-one with people. So if you like the stuff that I share, if it resonates, if you can feel it in your soul and you still have questions and you want more, those are the options for us cultivating a deeper relationship over time so that you can take your practice to the next level. So links for those options are available in the show notes. If you're interested, click the link that resonates with you most. Express your interest. I would love to have you come deeper into my ecosphere.
I also, if I take like Gabor Mate's mindset of like, it kind of reinforces this belief, if you've experienced violation or abuse, that there's something out there that is corrective and there's, again, something being done to you instead of you being you and kind of being in that energy. It's, again, another intrusion. And when he described it in that way, that was for me such a moment of like, oh, I don't want to do anything to my clients or for my clients. I just want to be with them. And I know that that is quite unconventional in a world that is really commodified therapy and psychotherapy language and is like all of the things, but I actually don't want to do anything. I believe they have it all over there. I love that somatic experiencing exercise. That's so beautiful.
Yeah. I was just speaking about this with a client the other day, yesterday, who's got this thing that, you know, I experience in my own life, like wanting to rush people who are close to him. He wants to rush their process of growth. And it's like in a very sensible way, like they're not aware of this. They don't want to change this thing. Like, why don't they want to change this thing? I'm so hungry to change these things about myself. Why aren't they? I operate like that too. So I very much understand where he's coming from. And we were speaking about how, you know, the universe over, if the universe has existed for about 13 billion years, I guess that's at least our best guess. And what the patterns over these 13 billion years have shown us is that all systems, so it's not just about humans being special and that humans can heal themselves. All systems in the universe move toward organization and coherence. When we're talking about organization and coherence in a human being, we're speaking about the brain and the heart communicating clearly, like the highways being open. We're speaking about the heart and the stomach communicating so that digestion is super efficient. All systems in the universe, think about a solar system being organized, like perfectly spinning around a center axis, organize themselves. And so the perspective that I like is like, it's not even that I'm special and I can heal myself. It's just that this process exists, this phenomenon exists. All I have to do is learn about the ways in which I'm inhibiting the phenomenon to express itself.
Yes. And that is absolutely unique, like just as unique as your fingertip, the way that your psyche has constructed itself out of fear or self-protection and all of these things that it's done. So the process of individuation and self-liberation doesn't happen. I often notice this specifically in my clients who have gone through infidelity or in the process of engaging in infidelity. And I'm like, what are these two people representing? And it's like, what are you like trying to organize in your system around attachment and relationship and what you believe you can have and what you can't believe you can have? And that's one that I often like, it's so stigmatized. And through being in this profession, I'm like, even in the most kind of hurtful, harmful, backwards relational dynamics, there's still this organization that's present. And that's one of, I think, the gifts of being a psychotherapist, is you get such an intimate view into how this system works and how it's optimizing towards growth and healing all the time.
But what I was picking up on was that you were saying, even in infidelity, the way that you're seeing infidelity is that these are two people who are trying to organize in the best possible way that they can organize. And it may be producing a result that they don't like, maybe even a result that's hurtful for both of them, but it's these two beings' best attempt at organization currently.
Yes. And I think like holding that lens as a psychotherapist of like whatever is going on in their world, removing the moral judgment, removing all of that, just holding like, how is their system trying to organize right now? And how is it getting in the way of that, even in the messiest of places? And when I was more in the psychedelic assisted psychotherapy research world, you really got to see that at play because you were kind of really diving much more deeper into people's unconscious dynamics and the blocks that we all have around our own liberation.
So this question is going to be a little bit Instagram tip therapist energy, but I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on is infidelity salvageable? So if someone cheats on someone, like, are there rules around that? I'm curious to hear your perspective on that.
I think it's absolutely salvageable, but it requires a level of communication and integrity and insight that oftentimes the individual or in the couple bubble don't have. And that's why the action has occurred. But I think absolutely it's salvageable. There are lots of things that make someone, quote unquote, a bad partner. Infidelity is not the only one, and it's not the worst one either. It's the one that's the most stigmatized. We've deemed it to be the worst quality in someone. But, you know, how is that in comparison to maybe being with a partner who never once picks up the kids?
I'd rather have someone cheat on me than not pick up the kids.
Yeah, but we don't hold it in that way or even pause and to think about, okay, like, is this the worst thing that could happen to me in my relationship? Or is this just what I've been told is the worst thing that could happen to me in a relationship?
Wow. That's my favorite perspective I've ever heard on that. I love that.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time in the infidelity bubble and I've experienced a lot of infidelity in my relationship.
I was going to ask you, and then I also like 14% was like, oh, maybe that's like too much. Like maybe you wouldn't want to share that. But I was going to ask you, have you ever been cheated on?
Yeah, it was a pretty repetitive theme in my relationship dynamic until I started to look into actually my own beliefs and my own internalized misogyny. And, you know, the fears that I had around asking for what I wanted, believing that I was worthy of more and all these complicated things, and also really coming into a place of trusting my intuition. And again, that kind of like self-knowing, that self-healing, because all of it was inside my system and acting out in my nervous system. And I felt it before I knew. I just didn't know what I didn't know, but I didn't know.
So have you changed that pattern, at least as far as you know?
As far as I know, yes.
Incredible. Yes. That's a significant change. I have not met a lot of people who have gone from being in the experience of a pattern of being cheated on to being able to change that pattern. So congratulations, because that's a very remarkable thing and a big deal. How do you show up in a relationship now that seems to, who are you and what are you doing now that seems to produce the result of not being cheated on?
I did a silent meditation retreat, and I've done a lot of time in silence. And one of them was with David Rico, or he came in and taught just very briefly. And he has this quote in his book, but he brought it up in there. And he was like, the foundation of adult relationships is not that I trust you, it's that I trust myself with whatever you do. And when I look back at like what was the most horrific about my infidelity experiences, it was like me calling repetitively, me texting, me wanting to get on a plane to like figure out what this woman is living with you, like me wanting to da-da-da, me wanting to talk about it. I'm like, that destroyed me, is seeing how I acted in response to such deep betrayal. Like how far I went in that rabbit hole. That was the pain. What you did, yeah, that sucked, but that's between you, yourself, and I. What I did in response, where I went, wow, that took a lot of time in psychotherapy to work out, to build trust again that I wasn't going to behave like that.
When you were, okay, so when you went into that black hole of 1,000 texts, 1,000 phone calls, 1,000 voice messages, buying the plane ticket, what, if you take a sincere look at that version of you, like what outcome was she trying to produce? What did she want?
Truth. I wanted the full truth. I got the little tidbit, okay, there had been infidelity, but I wanted the story so that I could go back in my mind and reconstruct what I thought was a sincere relationship or what I thought was genuine. And I wanted to go back and be like, okay, so that was real, but that wasn't real. And I wanted that kind of.
It's like you wanted the key for the map because you were trying to create a sense of safety for yourself by identifying what was real and what wasn't real about the experiences that you had in your relationship. So you needed the full story of the infidelity because that would have helped you put all the pieces together.
I was going to say, that's what I believed I needed to ensure that it never happened again. And then I had to realize that it's actually not about setting yourself up or believing it will never happen again. It could happen again. It's changing how you react to if it ever happens again.
You know, one of the things I find myself thinking about, like, it's interesting that we think of detectives as being a mostly male dominated role. The people who I know who have the greatest detective capacities are women. Like if a woman wants to find out something and put the pieces together, like give her one Instagram account, just give her Google and like any information will be extracted. And it's really interesting to hear you say this. And of course, that's not, you know, that's just my experience. I don't know what research says about that, but it's interesting to hear you. Okay. It's interesting to hear you say that your version of safety was putting all the pieces together in the story and finding out what was real and what wasn't, and that like accessing truth about the sincerity of the relationship and the connection would have been the thing that there was the thing that you were desperately grasping onto like oxygen. When I've been cheated on, I wanted to beat the other dude up. Like I wanted to assert power and dominance. And I actually one time in college did beat a dude up and I got so lucky that I didn't get in more trouble for it because it could have been absolutely horrible and I would not be here right now. But that's what I wanted, was to be seen as the person who was dominant.
Interesting. There could be a similar thing too, and me wanting the truth, being the one who now has more information than they did, wanting to reclaim that power. Like that's, I do think that was at play, of feeling so disempowered and being like, I'm going to get my power by like getting all the facts here and figuring it all out and making sure this never.
And is there something about the, like identity? Is there like femininity and womanliness with like power and information? Is there something there?
I think there is. I think there is like a piece there, because when you shared that about like a woman will find it, just give her Google. When my female clients come in and tell me stories, I'm like, I just want to take notes. No,
like with their detective strategies.
I'm like, that is next level. Like you should make that your career.
Like actually.
And also, let's talk about this.
Like this is a little much. The fact that you've developed, what I think a lot about, I think a lot about skill development. Like Michael, like a really cool perspective on Michael Jordan was like, yes, he's super athletic, but there's actually something about his spirit and his soul that needed to win more than anyone else. So his development of athleticism and skill lagged behind his soul's insane need to win. So I think about the relationship between like intensity of desire and skill development. So it's really funny to think about women having these detective skills that lag behind, that are the product of this intense desire to find information and to find truth.
Absolutely. I'm curious, your experiences of infidelity, how did you kind of change them, transform out of them? What did that look like for you?
Being cheated on? Mm-hmm. So when I got cheated on, I was 22 and in a relationship with someone who, and actually in many ways, like it of course was a toxic college relationship. And the way that I understood it, I even understood it at the time. I was like, oh, our darkness is in love with each other. And there's some light too, but neither of us know how to be light at this age. Like neither of us are empowered in any way to be who we want to be. But there was a lot of beauty in the relationship. And I just got super depressed and dark in college, and I shut the world out. And this poor woman was like with the most boring person on the college campus. Like all I wanted to do was read and hide away from the world. And she was super fun, and she was really beautiful and like got a lot of attention from a lot of dudes. It's like, you know, so I can understand that. But before summer break, she saw, this is like back when Facebook messaging was a thing. She found a Facebook message with this girl that I had grown up with from home. We were like flirting. I was saying something. So that happened on the day before we left. And then over the summer break, she just started to hook up with this guy who was there. And he was like very much the opposite of me. I had dried flowers and like patchouli in my fraternity room in college. And he had like customized beer, like 20, like cardboard box for beer cans, like artwork and thousands of beer cans around the apartment. So she just like went for another experience, and it totally at the time crushed me. But that thing that you said about the thing that you said is one of the most perfect things that I've ever heard in my life of like trusting. It's, can you say it again?
Yeah. The foundation of adult relationships isn't that I trust you. It's that I trust myself with whatever you do.
That is one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard. That's it. Because I didn't know at the time how to trust myself in response to anything that anyone would have done. And I went crazy. Like I grasped on to getting back this love. It became like my only source of oxygen. I was like weirdly riding my bike past this guy's apartment to like see if she was there. Like I moved in the direction of doing things that were like stalker weird energy that from the outside, not in that experience, I would have judged and been like, oh, that's like who would do those sorts of things. But I ended up doing those sorts of things, grasping on to being able to getting my status back and getting this love back. And yeah.
I don't know what your professional experience has been in this realm, but those like weird, graspy, clingy behaviors, I don't think, maybe there's a few clients who I can think of who genuinely don't have a story like that, but almost everyone has found themselves at one time in that really dark, sticky energy place, trying to hold on to something that maybe never existed or is definitely long gone.
Yes. And it, when I'm reflecting on my experience and I'm reflecting on, because I think you're so right, every single person I know has been in that place. And I'm thinking about what is that? Like what motivates that, or what are some of the principles there? One of the principles is in that place, I felt like well-being was a totally scarce resource. I had no idea. I thought that the only joy that I could ever experience again would come from this. She was a girl at the time. You know, she was 21. So, well, let's call her a woman. This woman would, I thought that the only source of joy would come from this woman being like, oh, actually, I want to be back with you. Like, I'm yours. Like, that was the worst mistake I ever made in my life. But I actually didn't even want that. Like, I didn't even want to be with her. And it's such a strange thing to attach the source of joy to getting this thing that I didn't actually even want.
Yeah, I definitely know in my experiences of infidelity, because they kind of continued on, like all of my relational experiences until I was about 25, all had really intense infidelity in them. And I wasn't attached to the men. I look back and it's not like I was obsessively messaging them because I wanted them. I literally thought having the truth, the narrative of how many times they had cheated on me, was my source of joy. And I'm like, that's just, now I look back, I'm like, well, that's just bananas. But I'm like, that was my truth.
It's so funny how when we see something as our only option, like truth is your only option for something. You probably didn't even know at the time what it was your option for. You were just operating with this like ravenous need for truth, without understanding the internal experience that you wanted to have. If I have truth, then I get calmness, groundedness, relaxation, peace. Your awareness is fixated on the concept rather than the internal experience that you want to have, hoping you're going to get if you get the concept.
Yeah. And I think that's most, what you just described is most of what leads people to be so unsatisfied in their relationships, is they're obsessed with the concept of what they believe a relationship should be or what it should look like, instead of actually feeling into it in a more intimate way.
What is your process? Like, how do you help people learn to become aware of what they're actually getting and experiencing when they're relating to someone or in a relationship?
I listen for the sub-narrative. Or I watch for the sub-narrative, meaning like, what is your body doing? How is your breath changing? Where is your eye contact going? Like, do you actually believe that the words you're telling me right now? And like, really, a lot of the work that I do with clients now is all focused around self-trust. Like going back to kind of where we started, like acknowledging there is this innate healing capacity within all of us. There is something around us supporting us. And like, can we tap into that? Can we trust that? Even if this is like the most messy, painful heartbreak, maybe there's a reason why you're going through this process. Can you trust that this is actually alchemizing something? How about for you? What is the thing you kind of fall back onto?
Can I boomerang you and ask you about alchemy? Because I want to tell you, but I'm really curious to hear the next step. Is that okay?
Yeah, the alchemizing process.
Yeah, so you are helping guide a person towards this understanding that this heartbreak, this pain may be material that you can use to transform into something else. So where do they go from there?
Such a beautiful question. Without going into one of their stories, I'll even just speak of my own. Like if I hadn't experienced so much relational pain, like so intensely, I would have never prioritized the relationship that I have with myself so intensely. I would have never done all that psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. I would have never spent so much time in meditation. I would have not dedicated like 3 years to psychoanalysis. I just wouldn't have done it. But I was in so much pain after one experience of infidelity where I would close the door, collapse, fall to the floor and cry for hours. And I couldn't get up. Like my whole body was just like, we're stuck here, this pain. And that is, you know, was so much of the foundation for me being like, wow, my whole whatever has been wrapped up in other men. Why am I so afraid to live my own life? And I see that in my clients' stories. If they are really willing to kind of surrender to pain and to loss, there is something else that emerges, but you do have to really like let it all go.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of resistance to that, which I totally get. And then some people just really get battered up and bruised so badly, they don't have another choice. Like letting go is all they've got.
So that other thing that emerges, that's on the other side of surrendering to that immense amount of pain. Do you think that that thing already exists and then the person's task is to just become something that already exists? Or do you think that in that place, like in the heart of all that pain, that a person, that it doesn't exist, like who they're supposed to become, and they get to choose who they become, they get to create themselves?
I do think it's always there. But I think our world, in so many ways, we have to mask up and create false core selves and protective strategies and da 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 da. I don't think there's a lot of things besides pain that can just kind of blast through all that stuff and really connect us to our deepest core. So I do think it's always there. I think it's like really covered up. Like I work a lot with death and with loss. Most people wouldn't know this about my practice, but it's because it's been so personally intimate in my life and my experience. And when my clients, it's quite unfortunate, they'll start working with me and then it seems to be a thing, like 4-6 months in, they lose someone quite intimate and they're forever different. There's no way. And some of them struggle with that for a while, but when the grief actually penetrates their heart, they're not the same person anymore. And it's very beautiful to witness. It's very moving. It constantly reminds me of all the stuff I have blocked around my heart and da 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 da. But it has kept me reminded that it's always there. It's not something we go find. It's just something we have to open ourselves up to.
And are you finding yourself getting better and better at using that wound in your heart as material for you to create who you want to be?
Yeah, I don't feel like in my life right now I necessarily like move from the wound in any way, or any way that I consciously see right now. It does feel like a source of a lot of creative inspiration for me, and writing and those types of things, or practices like painting. But the wound, it's a lot different now. It's like very held with a lot of compassion and love and gentleness.
I'm really glad to hear that. I find this thing with people where once a person starts to learn to be an alchemist, starts to learn to use their pain as creative material, actually some of the most essential creative material, and they start to trust themselves, like what you're saying. When I hear trust, what I hear is pattern prediction. So I don't necessarily use trust as like sacred word, like trust yourself. I say it's like, what are the most likely patterns that will, what's the trajectory? What's the most likely trajectory here? So trust for me is what are the patterns that I'm predicting in the future based on what I've seen in the past. When a person starts to enter a version of life where they trust, where they like what they are seeing in the future, they like this version of them, they like their capacity to build in the future, it seems like the more a person can appreciate the trajectory that they see for themselves and appreciate their empowerment and their capacity to create, the more they're able to love and appreciate all of the pain and difficult things that they've gone through. However, when a person does not feel empowered to create in the future, I find that that's the person who has a really difficult time forgiving and appreciating pain.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really beautiful way of saying it, because there hasn't been that lived experience yet of anything different.
Right.
And I know for many years of my life was very like lost in my little pain vortex, and pain is what I would have pattern predicted into the future, and pain is what I pattern predicted back. And yeah, I had no forgiveness. I was quite vengeful. I was quite spicy. I was all the things, because I didn't have any other different lived experiences just yet. And so yeah, it kind of goes to a place where I'm not necessarily like super thankful that I've experienced pain. I'm just like, that was an experience that's deeply changed me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like net neutral in my system now, which is also really lovely to no longer be like, oh, I'm going to alchemize all my pain, because I definitely went through that phase.
Okay. That is an alchemist. That's like the teen alchemist is a little bit sadistic with their pain. Like, give me it. I can take it all. I'm going to use this. That's super interesting. I love pointing those things out. Like I can't think of a good word to describe it, but the development of a certain archetype, and that the teen alchemist is like, like a little sadistic.
Absolutely. I can definitely look back and reflect and be like, oh my God, like I was choosing these experiences to have more pain so I could alchemize them. And I'm like, now I'm in a place in my life where I'm just like, you know what? Any day I can go back down memory lane and just remember my pain. If I feel bored or feel like I need something spicy in my life, don't need to do that right now.
Like, you have that skill. If you want to enact that skill, you can do that. But you,
one person drama.
Yes, right. Yes, you can do that. But you took on a super powerful perspective, which is that in order to maintain this identity of I can handle any pain I want and turn it into whatever, that means that I have to continue accumulating more and more painful experiences.
Yeah. And ultimately, that wasn't an identity that I knew served my highest growth.
And so what identity serves your highest growth now?
I love the question. It's actually one of neutrality. Yeah, finding the edges of neutrality, because it constantly expands me into curiosity and more compassion and more love, and just being in the mystery of things as well.
So I was going to ask you, what is the internal experience of neutrality? Because I'm not super convinced that neutrality exists. But I think I'm starting to put the pieces together in the framework you're speaking about, because you said curiosity, you may have even said awe and wonder. So tell me about, like, if you're writing a novella about your experience of neutrality, and we get to get intimate access into your inner experience of neutrality, like, what is neutrality for you?
It's the concept of both and, which sounds very simple, but it's so deeply profound. It's both and. It's both what I'm feeling and what they're telling me their experience is. It's both what I believe and their value system that is incompatible. It's both and all of the time. And the ability to hold that tension without having my central nervous system blow up or completely shut down is the neutrality I'm referring to. It's just like, can I hold both and?
Yes.
Can I continue to grow my capacity to sit with both at the same time?
Yes. Okay. So what I hear in that, by the way, incredible. Rather than your sense of safety needing, like, requiring that one truth exists or one worldview exists, you are cultivating a sense of safety by witnessing all of the truths that exist and not needing to somehow repress some truths and try and ignore them while pretending that only one exists. Your safety is being generated by the experience of witnessing curiously all of the different truths that exist, including your experience, but like witnessing your experience.
Yeah. A very dear friend of mine spoke this to me maybe like 9 months ago. And she's like, don't you just love going outside and just looking at all the people and going, wow, all having different experiences of consciousness right now. No one's better than the other, just all same consciousness and different bodies acting out different stuff right now. And that like really stuck with me of like, yeah, it's all just different experience, but who am I to hold it above one or the other? And actually the more unity between all of those different experiences comes with practicing more neutrality and having more capacity to hold it all.
So you are not seeing different forms and expressions of consciousness hierarchically. They're all on the same Bob Ross color palette. They're just different colors to select from.
I know, as uncomfortable as that is.
it's, we, like, you know, what's the guy's name? David Hawkins? right? Like, he makes it very clear that he believes strongly in a hierarchy. He has very biased language towards like bliss and love. It's bigger, it's higher. I think that is like kind of being dry and a little bit of like intellectually arrogant asshole. Like, that's a really bad framework, because if the goal is love, seeing love as better than despair or sadness sets you up to experience less love. It's a bad strategy. What seems to produce if the intended result is love, if bliss is at the top and that's the intended result, then what I find to be true is like, okay, what is it like? What's the experience of relating to all things blissfully, including all things in the experience of bliss, including all of the things that are stigmatized and we're told we're supposed to hate and reject? Cheating is one of them. Sadness, depression, loneliness, fear, anger.
I would love to hear kind of your perspective on this. So one of my favorite quotes from Cheryl Strayed is like, it's always too early in the story to know who the good guys and the bad guys are. I look back at my experience of infidelity at 24, 25. It was horrendous. Did he need to do that to me? No. Was it absolutely inappropriate for him to be dating someone that young and orchestrating all of this madness with other women? Hands down, that was not a nice experience to put any human through. And it was my deep initiation for me to wake up and go, I do not love myself. I don't know how to love myself. So I look, you know, in that, you know, when I was in that experience, you know, perceivably he was the bad character in my mind, and he continued to be for a while. And now I look back, I'm further along in my story. He's actually a pretty great character.
Because he spurred self-realization and self-actualization.
Absolutely. So I'm curious for you, like, that perspective of it's always too early in the story to know the good and the bad characters. It's like, how do we hold that when we speak of despair and sadness and depression and pain? Of again, it kind of goes back into that alchemy.
Such a good question. I operate with the perspective that everything that I experience, I choose, I attract, and I'm attracted to. And I have been through very hard things and have experienced like traumas that exist in this, on the spectrum of trauma. That's like an, oh shit type of thing. And I'm not trying to trauma compare, but I think it's important to communicate that, to say that this perspective is available even when having experienced those types of things. I personally choose to operate with the perspective that even those things that happen that I experience, like, on some level, I'm choosing, attracting, and attracted to. The reason I choose to operate with that perspective is because that allows me to say, okay, so when those things are happening, who am I and what am I doing that seem to be related to the experience that I'm having? And I certainly, this is not something that I think that people have to take on. I don't think that people have to take that perspective. And so very careful to say that that's the one that I choose to practice, because I don't operate with an understanding that any of this shit is true. These are all just perspectives and spells that help us access a particular internal state, you know? So it's not like this, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, who knows. What I want is the experience of empowerment. I want the experience of, I can take this thing that happened or that I experienced, and I can turn it in, I can create with it. I can create who I want to be, and here's how I'm going to use this particular thing. When I was experiencing more of X, Y, and Z, well, who was I? Is that who I want to be? If yes, if I say to myself, yes, when I was experiencing these things, let's say it's getting cheated on, I was the exact person that I want to be, and I have no desire to be anyone else, then I'm going to continue to be that person and I'll probably continue to produce that result, choose, attract, and be attracted to that result. However, if I ask myself, well, no, or if I say, no, that's not who I want to be, who do I want to be? The thing that I get really curious about is what internal experience do I want to have? And that's what life is for me, is the practice of internal experiences, like making choices about what I'd like to experience internally, curiosity, awe, wonder, peace, bliss, joy, exuberance, zest. And now how can I relate to my external world in ways that produce those things for me? And if I'm interacting with another being who wants those things too, produces it, contributes to that being's experience. So when I'm thinking about who I want to be, I'm really thinking about what internal experience do I want to have? And then my personality, my identity, and my persona is just this sort of like balloon floating in the wind that's guided by whatever choices I'm making about what I want to experience internally. And that thing for me, that framework seems to produce, it seems to help me attract and be attracted to and choose the things that really align with how I want to feel and how I want to experience life.
Do you feel like that's been like a trajectory though of like getting to that place now of like also having maybe the discrepancy of internal experiences? Like, oh yeah, it can be all the way over there and it can be over here. And like now you know how to choose and orchestrate how to be more in one or control being more in one than the other.
Yes. I had a mentor for almost 2 years. He gave me a whole lot of valuable things. And one of the things that he gave me was this tool that he developed called the WANTS exercise, WANTS. So in his framework, there are strategies, wants, and needs. Needs are love, safety, and belonging. And in his perspective, we're never not experiencing love, safety, and belonging. If we're not experiencing love, safety, and belonging, we'd be dead. So being alive indicates that there's a version of love, safety, and belonging being experienced. It just may not be the version of love, safety, and belonging that aligns with the experience of life that I want to have. Maybe I've been conditioned to believe that my best version of love, safety, and belonging is being hurt by the people that I'm in relationships with. And that has me in one particular framework. And what I get to do in my life is upgrade those frameworks so that I'm experiencing a version of love, safety, and belonging that I actually like and what I want. Then in the wants, there are the internal experiences, curiosity, joy, awe, wonder, anger, if I wanted. Like there's no hierarchy to it. There's just colors to pick from. And then strategies are the actions, the words, the thoughts, it's like the things to do that seem likely to generate the wants. And it took a long time of practicing seeing myself and seeing the world that way to start to develop this awareness of, oh, what's actually happening, what I'm seeing this other person do, I know that this other person as a system in the universe, like any other system, is moving towards coherence and organization, which is love. That's the way that I see it. They're moving towards love. The intention is love. They're just using a strategy that's not producing the intended result. And if I were to actually create a space where I were to say to this person, hey, you're hurting this other person. Like, what are you looking to get from this? What do you hope happens as a result of doing that? And I get to help this person cultivate an awareness of what they're actually looking for. Then I set them up to be able to choose strategies that actually produce the intended internal results they're looking for. So, and then of course, applying that to myself. So it's a very like practicing awareness of the desired internal experience, operating with the assumption that everything is moving towards an experience of organization and love. Most people are just living their lives unclear of the internal experience they want to have. Like they're not aware that they're looking for groundedness when they're sending 1,000 texts. They think what they want is an answer, you know? So yes, it took months to really get it, a vigorous practice. And I'm understanding it more and more every single day. It's absolutely been a process.
I'm so curious about it now. Yeah, it sounds very interesting. I like it.
What has your process been like?
To coming kind of to more to this place that I am right now, I really needed the somatic embodied experiences of something different. So when you talk about that internal state place, my history is one of a lot of sexualized violence, a lot of abuse, a lot of domestic violence, specifically kind of 20 and under, pretty heavy. And I just didn't have that experience of joy, love, ease. It just was not in my central nervous system. I didn't know what that was. And then I started participating in psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, and I got embodied experiences of those things. And then once my central nervous system knew what that was, just even that on, you know, of the initial experiences, then I had something to really grasp onto of like, oh, this is an internal experience I could create. Mm. This is a way that I could live. And then it almost just kind of started happening quite naturally on its own that like, I could go do that thing, but I know it's going to feel like X, Y, and Z, or I could just stay at home and read a book and I know it's going to feel like this. And I know inside my system, just because of all those years of pain, I'm quite hardwired to go that way. I know that. And so I know that I have to have a lot of practices that keep me over here and keep reminding me that that's actually not a state that I need to live in. So it's like, as you're describing, I was like, oh, very similar, yeah. Very similar, different language, but parallels.
Yeah, I'm hearing you describe the exact same thing. You're like, awareness of the internal experience of one direction, awareness of the internal experience of the other direction. Now, I operate with the perspective that, you know, when if you are in that place of life where you're making choices that move you toward pain or hurt, I believe that that is you moving towards organization in the best possible way that you know how. Like that is you moving towards love in the best possible way you could.
I know, controversial opinion, but I also 110% agree in my own personal bubble. And when I look back at my own actions and ways that I've harmed people and not acted in ways that I'm maybe proud of or feel like were in my integrity, I'm like, that was me like getting out of integrity to feel how that felt so that I could kind of push myself back in or find the way back in. And I think that is like a part of also the messiness of being human and not judging any of it as much as you can of just like, that's how you learn. Sadly, or maybe greatly, I don't know.
But kind of both. Both are true. Both are true. It yeah. produces a lot of sad things. There are a lot of sad things. And also it's great that we can have these conversations about all the mistakes that we've made, all of the time and energy we've spent not conscious, like wanting love and belonging, but not knowing how to consciously choose love and belonging. So just going with the thing that was available to us, operating with an understanding that joy isn't safe, so these other things are safe. You know, like I'm so glad for both of us that we've gotten to a place in life where we see other people in the world that way. It's just a really powerful thing. And not only is it powerful to me, I'm always thinking about what I want to do is create. In every single moment, I want to create at the highest possible level. I want to know, I want to trust that I can take my boldest, grandest vision and turn that into reality. So I'm evaluating everything through the lens of what helps me do that. When I'm shaming and judging people and saying like, oh, she's a slut for doing that or whatever, I'm hindering my capacity to create. When I choose to see things with wonder, awe, operate with the assumption that everyone is doing the best that they can currently to access love, my creative capacity explodes. So yes, it's like sacred and beautiful to see the world that way. It's also highly functional.
Yeah, I remember right at the start of my first master's degree, we got in this like huge intellectual debate that at that time I was a lot more fiery. So I was like a lot more participating in. Now I wouldn't say anything. I'd just be like, oh, where's the popcorn? Chilling. I'm like, yeah. That's... Anyways, that time, that's not what it was. And there was a classmate who was like, I don't believe people are doing the best that they can at all times. And for me, that was just like I could not understand, because I'm like, fundamentally, all of us, based on the knowledge that we have, are doing our own strategies to position and find our way closest to having our needs and wants met so we can feel at peace. And that frame, it does allow you to function in a different way in the world. It allows you, when conflict happens or situations are sticky or weird stuff, you can just go, okay, that's their best. It might be not what I choose to experience again, but that's their best.
And,
okay, cool.
And let's say, like, if we're seeing, okay, that's their best, that creates space for us to ask, do they like their best? Because if I'm coming at someone and being like, that's not your best, like all of that annoying fucking energy, like I'm not helping that person in any way. Whereas if you're just saying, okay, yes, whatever they're doing in this moment is the absolute most perfect adaptation possible, given every single event in every particle that has ever happened in the 13 billion years of the universe, they could not be doing anything other than what they are doing right now as they are moving towards love. Mm-hmm. Do they like what they're doing? What do they like? What don't they like? What would they like to be better? I really like the perspective of this moment right here is perfect and it gets to be better. And I love the idea of meeting people with the assumption of perfection, which doesn't mean that it's void or devoid, I don't know what the word is there, of errors or mistakes or problems. It actually means that there are exciting problems we get to solve and things that we love that we can continue to invest more energy into.
Yeah, as you were speaking about that kind of energy of like, that's not their best, or kind of the attacking, whenever I find myself there or maybe even kind of confused with the client, I just go, what would the internal experience of that best be? And then I can go kind of back into my history mode of like 25 and under and go, oh, it would not feel good. And then I notice inside myself a better, higher version of me pops up. And it's like, okay, is there anything I can do to co-regulate with this person that maybe right now does not deserve my co-regulation? But like my best self can actually do that.
I really like that. It can
actually remember what that felt like and have a lot of empathy.
And it's interesting to operate with the perspective of they may not deserve this right now, but what I'm hearing, like, yes, it's about them, but that's really about you. Because if their ego, or in the internal family systems framework, like if their part is forward facing and you get activated and triggered so that you're seeing them through the lens of your part or parts, you no longer have connection to your capital S self. Whereas when you're in your capital S self, you see your parts that are activated, you see their parts that are activated, you're lovingly relating to all of them, and you're lovingly relating to their capital S self, which they may not be currently aware of.
Absolutely, yes. IFS has definitely changed my capacity for relationship and holding that with people, especially in times that have been sticky in my dating life or in my relational life, of just like, okay, like your behavior right now shows that you're not connected to your big capital S self or highest self. You're acting out of a part, but can I still find some connection to it by showing up in that version of me without judgment? There's no right or wrong. There's going to be moments when I'm in a part and you're ideally, you know, holding that space in the room. But that framework for me has been so transformative in how I relate to myself and relate to others.
You know how when we get trained as therapists, we're like trained not to praise people that much? I don't ever listen to that, because like when I feel sincere hype man energy, like I have to say it. And I'm so happy for you that you've been able to access that experience of life. I mean, as a practitioner, yes, of course, like that's so next level. That's so incredible. And I just know that the results that you're able to contribute to and participate in for your clients are incredible. But just as a person, that you've had the painful experiences you've had. You've had the trauma that you've had, and here you are like relating to everyone's capital S selves and choosing to love people, even if that person has no access to capital S self and is in a space in life where all they know how to do is hurt people. Like, it's just a remarkable thing that you've been able to access that. And I'm so happy for you.
Thank you. I love that you made the comment about the hype, because I do. I give my clients a lot of praise. I'm like super open with that. And it was to go back to something you said earlier about kind of the ethos or your philosophy around like attracting things or bringing them in. In my own ethos, I definitely do not subscribe or think everyone should fall into this belief system in any way. But through my own kind of personal work, I've had to go back into my experiences of sexualized violence and you know, a lot of the psychotherapy work that I did there that I found to be quite transformative was actually being guided to imagine what it felt like to be in their body to harm someone and then go, oh, I'd rather be in mine than to be that energy. I'd rather be over here. And that like poofed something in my system where it was just like, oh, whenever we're enacting violence or violating or harming someone, it doesn't feel good for anyone. And then something kind of shifted in those experiences for me where there was just a deeper understanding and deeper compassion and this like very sincere, like, I want to know your big capital S self. Like, I believe it's there and you might not act out of it and you might not know it, but I'm going to hold that vision. Even if we're just meeting and you're kind of very aggressively hitting on me at the bar, I'm still going to show up in my big S self. And if you get dangerous, I'm going to leave, but I'm going to try here.
That is incredible. So you're practicing and you're imagining what, I love that you're going back into the body, because when someone is hurting someone else, the thing that's happening is that they're having an experience in their body and they're, I would bet my life that they're not aware of how horrible that thing feels in their body. I don't think I would bet my life that 99% of human population internally feels horrible when they see any other thing in pain and suffering. And then to think about like being the cause of that pain, the amount of pain for the causer in that moment must be tremendous. And then if they were aware of that pain, there's no way they would be doing it. They have to be, I think, operating with an almost unimaginable amount of repression and suppression of it. But if they were aware of the pain, there's no way that they could do it.
I wrote about this exact thing like years ago in an article about sexualized violence. I was a part of a campaign on BuzzFeed, Project Unbreakable. They photographed survivors of sexualized violence. It went viral. I wrote an article years later about it. And what I wrote was like the level of disembodiment, someone who enacts sexualized violence on another body is the same level of disembodiment that the victim is left with to experience. It like you have to be that disconnected and that disembodied to not feel something when you're harming someone else. When you're acting out of integrity, let that be as extreme as sexualized violence or let that be infidelity, you have to be disconnected. And through that disconnection, just like, you know, being out of integrity and then you pop back in, there is this alchemy that's trying to find its way. And sometimes finding its way is really sideways. And I'm speaking more to the infidelity pieces. I could be much more nuanced and obviously much more clear. And if we were just speaking about sexualized violence, I'd be saying a lot of other things right now. So I want to make that clear.
Yep.
That disembodiment piece is so present. And we often don't think about that when we are being harmed by someone.
And it makes sense to not think about that during or after being harmed by someone. And also, the what I appreciate so much about your perspective, like we could say, wow, that's such a compassionate perspective. Like, wow, how empathetic. Wow, she's such a good person for thinking about. Yes, it's compassionate and empathetic, but back to that perspective of creation, if we want to produce different results, if we want to reduce the rate of sexual violence or people harming anyone else in any way, it's like, yes, your perspective is beautiful and compassionate, but it's to me, it's the only perspective that's going to actually change anything.
I was just going to say, I spent a lot of time in third wave feminism and it's not working. It's not working. And so that's why I got very kind of obsessed with masculinity in my own journey. And I'm so grateful. I have the most amazing male friends. It's actually the thing I'm most proud of in my life are my male friendships. They mean so much to me. But I take it as a testament of my like very ruthless dedication to hear third wave feminism and incorporate what worked and challenged what didn't. And to really have that as a central practice in my life. What are the principles that work here that are amazing? And what is not working? What is actually keeping me stuck from understanding the other experience right now?
Keeping you stuck and also producing the external result of reducing the rate of crimes like that, or people hurting people like that, you know, like I'm curious to understand the experience of a person who hurts another person. I'm also curious to understand the person who thinks that the best approach is to blame the person. You know, I hold myself accountable to that, right? I also just do not think that like blaming and alienating is the thing that's going to produce the intended result of reducing the likelihood of those horrible things happening. I think that the approach that you're taking is the thing that, or is one of the element, the necessary ingredients to producing large social and cultural change. Because what the perspective that I operate with is that if a person is embodied, if they are aware of what's happening, like then they are intrinsically motivated to make certain decisions that help them feel good. I don't know anyone who, when given the actual option, does not choose to feel good. All organisms move in that direction. So if a person is cultivating an awareness of what's happening in them internally, if they're embodied, like it's almost impossible to imagine that someone would make choices to be harmful like that if they are aware of the things that are happening in any given moment.
And if they have that cultural container where they have actual options, like a robust option list. And that's one of the reasons why I enjoy working with men so much and hold it as so sacred to me is men don't have a lot of spaces to practice being emotionally open, to disclose their history, to process things, to learn new vocabulary, to have a really safe, non-leaky sexual container with another woman where they're like, they know that these are the boundaries. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They can say what they want and it's going to stay this way. Where they're not going to be judged in those ways, where they can ask questions. And I remember quite early on in my career, like looking around at the resources for men who experienced sexual violence or sexual abuse. And at that time in Canada, there was 1.5 centers. So the center was closing, but there was only one place in the whole country for men. And I remember that being just such a heartbreaking moment when I looked at my own life and all the resources and all the options and all the feminist spaces that I had had available to me. And then I thought of some of the men that I loved the most who experienced these things and just went, oh, wow, patriarchy has really constructed this so they don't change. Mm-hmm. And that was really great because it's created these spaces outside of patriarchy and pushed aside and whew, like love that. And men haven't been able to organize in that way to create those spaces. Yep. And what does that mean?
Yep. And what you are inspired to solve the problem of patriarchal systems by helping men heal. And what's really beautiful about that is like what you were saying about third wave feminism, like you're doing that on the shoulders of third wave feminism. So if the insularity hadn't been created there and the blame hadn't been created, like it's not likely that you would be in this spiritual, emotional, in like mental position to make that choice.
No, which is why I can't look back at any of it and judge it or have that kind of more hostile attitude that sometimes we put with people who identify as feminist. I don't have any of that. I was like, wow, they did their absolute best. This is incredible. I'm here. What's the next rendition? What's the next version? What can we learn from this? How have me embodying these principles not worked in my life? Okay. What do we do next?
Yes. I love that. Like the very pragmatic. So I like you probably heard this come up a few times, like this really, like I love pragmatism. I love saying, what's the result we are looking to produce here? Because I think it allows us, when we're clear on the result that we want to produce, it allows us to be in our heart and have a greater capacity to change things. So like, the result that you're looking to produce is what I'm hearing, like a transformation in the experience of being a man. And that produces other results too, like in a whole bunch of different results. And what you're doing is holding yourself account, given where you are and what's available to you right now, you're holding yourself accountable to taking what is the most likely to be effective approach to producing the result that you want, which is actually learning to open your, like, love men.
Yeah. I think of this oftentimes when I'm working with a female client and they'll come in and share a bad dating story or even a story of sexualized violence. And I'll just kind of go through my mind and Rolodex, like, what male friend have I spent the most time with recently? And I just actually imagine embodying their central nervous system and their energy in that moment. I'm just like, this client doesn't have a positive reference point of the masculine. I have many embedded inside my body right now. Which one am I going to call upon? Can I actually use that as a resource to just kind of be in the room and be in the dynamic and start to play with that? And I've noticed it's definitely changed how I show up as a practitioner. And then just comes about for me, I'm just imagining being in this energy that I experience when I'm with this really safe, beautiful masculine figure. And now my client is by proxy, maybe just even getting a little bit of that. And that's also a lot of the work that I do with those who are femme identifying is, you know, if they have that type of curiosity and capacity and both and in their system, that's going to, you know, change all of their relationships if they start to practice that in their own mind-body system first.
That's one of the most next level things that I've ever heard. I don't think I've ever even thought about doing something like that in sessions with people. Like what's the archetype that would be most healing for this person right now? It's really cool because in the most pragmatic way, like you're focused on the results of helping this person, contributing to this person's healing. It's not about you being the healer. You're just like the vessel for different energies to be experienced and to relate. And then you call in safe masculine archetypes and energies that you've experienced. You invite those into you to be there with this person, and you trust that that's the thing that's going to organize them in a new way that is more aligned with the experience of life and of men that they want to have.
I definitely really hold that was a huge catalyst for me, was when I kind of like had that crumble metamorphosis, like really bad relationship. There were men that started to show up in my life, and it gave me this context point of like, it doesn't always have to be this way. It doesn't always have to be so painful. It could be quite different and quite beautiful. And specifically when I first kind of got my counseling hat on, I was working extensively in sexualized violence, like all the time. And I remember this one session, I'd just been like, I felt gutted. Like the story was horrific. They were in horrific pain. And I actually just laid on the floor I called my boyfriend at the time, who was this super chill surfer dude. Yes. I was just like, just talk to me about the wave. Like, that's all yes. I wanted him to do.
Oh my God. That was like, he's been waiting for that opportunity his entire life.
Yeah, it's impressive. And he just talked to me about the wave. And I was like, after, you know, it went on for 10, 15 minutes and we hung up and I said the next client, I was like, I feel fine now. And it was like this imprint of like safe masculine. And then after that, for about 3.5 years in my practice, every day that I saw a client who experienced sexualized violence, I made a plan to see a male friend.
Wow.
And I was like, I needed that polarity in my system to not be pulled into the narrative of all men being one way or believing that masculine meant the imprint I was kind of experiencing with my female clients or femme clients at that time.
Wow.
And it's still a practice I hold. It's why they're so important relationships, because I know they actually allow me to do this work in a way that's safe for me and my body and my belief system as well.
That's one of the most amazing things that I've ever heard. Also, like your dedication to your craft is incredible. That's amazing that you orient your light. Like, it's like you're, I don't have the words to describe like what I'm experiencing, but you're like, you're choosing to be this funnel and then to concentrate really potent energy into your clients. Like you're very consciously gathering experiences that you know will imprint you and your soul and your energy and your nervous system. And those things you'll show up to your sessions with, and that it'll make you more effective. But it's not like a you thing. It's really like the collection of these energies and these experiences. You're the curator of these energies and these experiences.
I'm curious about, yeah, how you hold this in like the clients that come to you and in your practice, because I definitely believe like energetically and on a more metaphysical spiritual level, I'm like, every client who has ever sat across from me has been a teacher. Every single one. They have either like been a reflection of something way back there that's not healed, their reflection of something that's coming for me from the future and I should have like really picked up and listened a lot more, or we're just energetically like at the same frequency. And I'm curious kind of how you hold that, because that's what gives me such dedication to it, because I'm like, there's some weird cosmic stuff going on here I don't understand, so I'm better like
I better be fully committed. I love that I think I'm similar in the way that you operate. My motivation and devotion to living every single moment of my life, like as an attempt to amplify the internal experience that I want to have. I know that it puts me in the 0.01% of people as devoted and dedicated. I see it as, I don't know if I would say duty, because it doesn't feel like duty. It's more of like an honor to be able to give. And I want to be a absolutely like beaming ball of loving light. And I want to help my clients have an experience that every single thing about them is lovable, even the worst possible thing that they could tell me, even their darkest, ugliest thing. Like, I can be in a state of love as I am receiving the thing that they're saying. Now, just like you said, every client is a teacher. There will be things that come into my awareness or come into my field that I have not yet been conditioned to be in a state of love as I relate to. And that for me is where clients are the teacher. Like, oh yes, I hate this thing that you're saying, or wow, I'm judging this immensely, or this brings up fear, anxiety. To be honest with you, it doesn't happen that often. I've had some clients who I just like, I don't vibe with that much. And I see those as teachers too. But for me, the teaching there is like, I'm going to honor my preferences here, and I'm going to move in the direction of people that like that, you know, even if they're really sad and they're depressed, like I actually haven't even really thought about this, but sometimes with certain people, even if they're really sad and in a really dark place, like it just feels good to be with them. And that's something that I optimize for. Like I want it to be enjoyable for me to learn to love the ugly things that they share with me. And it's not enjoyable with everyone. And part of what the process has been for me is like, I would like it to be enjoyable. So I choose clients where I enjoy it.
Yeah, that's also been, and this kind of fits the frame of everyone being a teacher and that being like very, very different. I remember about a year and a half ago, a really good friend of mine who's a peak performance psychologist, he said to me, I was like, kind of like, oh, I want to change my practice, like da 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 da. And he was like, your life is going to get a lot better when you realize that pain doesn't have to be a part of your occupation. And I was just like, and I was like, yeah, it doesn't. And all of these people have been teaching me for so long that I can actually say no. I didn't get to say no when I was a child. I didn't get to say, no, this is too much. No, this is too hard. No, this hurts my heart. But as an adult today, I do get to say no. And there's people who love doing that work, who want to be there, who feel joy in that. And I was one of them at one time, and now I'm not.
That's incredible. What's that line? Pain?
That your life will get so much better when you realize pain doesn't have to be a part of your occupation. I was like, oh, spoken like a real peak performance psychologist.
Like what a absolute arrow of a truth. Like that is a aerodynamic dart that when that hits, you can't deny how you had been previously optimizing for pain and operating with narratives about how you're supposed to be enduring that pain and how you're a bad person and you abandon people or whatever, if you don't choose that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely. And there was at one point where it didn't feel that way at all. And then I kind of got into my own stories, my own complexes around like needing to be there or this sense of abandonment. And then it was so liberating when I just said like, no, I actually like, I don't work with that anymore. Or I could, but I don't want to. It doesn't actually feel good for me. And because it doesn't feel good for me, I actually know I'm not the best person and the best version of myself to support you. And you deserve the best. And that's not me.
I love that. I love that perspective. I just in the Q&A that I did with my online community, right before I came on here, we were speaking about like this exact thing. A person had not consciously designed pain in their profession, in their career. And we were speaking about how like they may be at this precipice right now where for the first time in their life, they get to make the bold choice of feeling good. Like they get to walk down the path of feeling good if they want to. Now, if we're not seeing this hierarchically, good is not better than pain. It doesn't speak to any kind of absolute truth. We just know that we like feeling good better than we like being in pain. And if we want that, then we can create that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I know for myself, it's been so interesting now, the type of clients I get, the energy, how light it feels, all of these interesting things. And I've also had to check myself and be like, okay, now that there's no pain here, where is the pain starting to pop up?
Mm-hmm.
It's like a different, you know, different level of mindfulness of like, okay, like it's always going to be here. It's just like, okay, well, like, are we checking on it? Is it conscious? Is it unconscious? Is it manageable, unmanageable? How much attention are you giving it? How much are you not? These types of things.
That reminds me of, so for clients who have a high intellectual capacity, who we would call like really smart clients, one of my favorite things about them is when they're like, well, we spoke about this 2 weeks ago, so I thought I figured it out, but then it like happened every single day since we spoke about it. And like, I know that thing because I do it too, like speaking about it, thinking like, okay, I understand it. So it's over. What I hear you saying is like, as you continue to as you get even better at choosing to feel good and get better at feeling good, optimizing for your well-being, designing systems and environments around you that help you access that, you're clearing out space to identify pain that you may not have been able to be aware of previously, new expressions of pain. My guess is that you or I will never have an experience of life where we are, I can't, again, void or devoid. I don't, what is it? Void or devoid? Void.
Void.
Where we're void of pain. We just clear more space so we can learn new versions of pain and we get better at relating to pain.
Absolutely. And that consciousness around it too. Like, you know, there's a long time in my practice where I wasn't super conscious that I was being hurt and harmed in the experiences. It was too close to home. I didn't know how to have these boundaries, etc. And now it's like, okay, you know, I know that if I choose to get up super early so I can go for a run, that I'm going to put my body in pain because I didn't get enough sleep. And I'm like, that's the level of pain we're working with here.
Yeah.
That's much different than what it once was when I chose partners who I knew were going to be unfaithful because I didn't believe I was worth anything more.
I love that perspective. Yes.
But different.
Yeah, I really, really, really like that perspective a lot. Okay, let me go back to not listening to our training to praise. So I can say that this really has been one of my favorite conversations that I've ever had. Like, your perspective to me is so on point. I don't have the capacity to imagine a more on point perspective. Like, I really love the way that you see things and approach things. And maybe there are better perspectives available. I haven't yet. I'm not aware of them. So I just really appreciate you and what you bring. You're also really great at communicating them. Like, everything that you said was super clear and helped me understand things even better. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was so nice to have like a genuine back and forth and feel an exchange of energy and all those things. It was such a delight to just be here and do that with you.
And so cool to me that as a we're both therapists we're doing stuff on Instagram. We both don't seem to follow the rule of not self-disclosure. And I love that so much. And if people don't know, there's like sort of the old world of therapy is that therapists are not supposed to share details about their lives and their experiences. That was like on this trajectory of therapy, so desperately wanting to be seen as a legitimate objective science and like operating with the hope that a therapist could be objective. That just is not, I just don't think objectivity even exists. So I love how boldly you own your experience as well.
I think it's such a good reference point because it's what allows me when you share X, Y, and Z, I'm not sitting over here judging you because like I did D, E, and F.
Yes.
No!
Yes. And X, Y, Z.
Yes. Maybe a few
times. Yes. A handful. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate you.
Thank you.
I really meant it when I said that was one of my favorite conversations that I've ever had in my life. Ailey's perspective to me is truly at the cutting edge of what is available, like in terms of how anyone can think about the world currently. Not just think about the world, but love the world. Ailey, thank you so much for being on here. Thank you for being you. Thank you for sharing your perspective with us. We really appreciate you, and thank you all so much for listening.